said. It was one of the warnings, right? Yes. We were on tour in Wisconsin. We tour a lot. The route we were taking would have had us on the Hohen Bridge in Milwaukee, right at the minute it collapsed. I mean, give or take, sure. But the odds were damn good. Only reason we weren't is because you told us it would fall. Way we see it.
Here he gestured at the rest of the chorus.
You saved all our lives. Helping you out here seems like the least we can do.
Yeah, Will said.
Guess so.
He turned and walked to the exit, Lee at his side.
Please, Celica Man said as they passed, from within the ring of singers. Just one thing. Let me ask you just one thing.
Outside, Will and Lee gathered their belongings from the town car and transferred them to their new vehicle, a late-model light blue Nissan sedan. Will left the Lincoln's keys on its driver's seat. Then they got in the sedan and drove away, back to I-80 West. That lasted for about 2 miles, until Lee abruptly pulled over to the side of the expressway, slamming on the brakes and sliding to a stop. She looked at Will, her eyes wide, her face ashen.
How? She said. How?
Will nodded. He reached for the Oracle notebook and opened it, flipping to the front, to the fourth page. He ran his finger down the list of predictions, stopping about 2/3 of the way through. He held the notebook up for Lee to read. July 21st, 11:07 a.m. A man reveals himself in a laundromat.
Chapter 37.
So the Oracle's in Ohio, the president asked.
Daniel Green tapped the end of a pen against his desk, a dark, elaborately carved thing built from the timbers of the HMS Resolute. Queen Victoria had presented the desk to the United States in 1880, and every president since Hayes had used it in the Oval Office, with the notable exceptions of Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. Anthony Loyston, sitting in an armchair on the other side of the desk, knew the president hated the thing, but he was superstitious enough to not want to be lumped in with the guys who hadn't used it.
Yes, Loyston said. Or he was. The coach is on it, though. We'll know where he is wherever he goes.
The coach, the president said, his tone sour. Okay. What's Mr. Dando doing?
Nothing, as far as we can tell. Just driving. No new predictions. Nothing. He's with the reporter.
Huh. Okay. Let's keep our distance. We have a deal with the man, after all. What about the other two? The Sheikhs?
They've left the United States, chartered a jet with an onboard medical suite, hired doctors, and flew on out.
The president narrowed his eyes.
We let them go?
We can't hold them. They're covered under the, arrangement with the Oracle. They don't seem to want to cause any trouble. Hamza Sheikh is focusing his energy on making sure Reverend Branson spends the rest of his life in prison. As for that, sir, it looks like the New York DA's office is seriously considering issuing an indictment. Should we intervene? Loyston said. I know you and Branson are close. We could exert influence on his case. Behind the scenes, of course.
The president frowned, his pen tapping out in a regular rhythm against his desk.
No, he said, the pen going still. I warned that asshole to stay away from the Oracle. He deserves what he gets. Anything else? Green said. This has been a long day. The doctor will be here in about 15 minutes, and I need a little recharge time.
The president had asked for a daily cancer screening ever since the meeting with the Oracle, and it was taking its toll. Not the physical invasion of the blood tests, but the wait for the results. So far, all negative. But one day they wouldn't be. And the weight of that knowledge was pulling Green down, a little more each day. The price of the future.
"One last thing," Loyston said. "The situation in Central Asia. I have an update."
"Kandustan?" the president asked. "I saw something about it in the security briefing this morning. It's still developing, right?"
Loyston nodded.
"Yes. I'll briefly summarize for you, sir. We have a warlord. Turakul," he said, stumbling slightly over the unfamiliar pronunciation. "He's the leader of a tribe, an ethnic minority that has a history of squabbling with anyone and everyone in the area over the past several hundred years. He's apparently managed to organize his people, and he's come out from the hills with a small army and invaded the capital, a place called Uth. It's street fighting, ugly bloody stuff. Turakul says he just wants control over a mosque with some historical significance to his tribe. But based on what the CIA pulled together on this guy, he's probably planning to slaughter everyone he can."
The pen started tapping again.
"But as I said, I have an update," Loyston said. "Good news, potentially."
"I'll be damned," Green answered. "I think I've forgotten what good news sounds like. Do tell."
"Representatives from the two sides have brokered a temporary peace. Apparently, there is a cultural system in place in the region for resolving disputes. It's called a Council of Bees. Elders from both sides convene in some hidden spot in the mountains and try to work it out. This particular council has 35 people in total, 17 from each side plus a neutral party acceptable to both who can vote to break a deadlock. If things go well with the process, then that's that. The fighting stops, and they all get on with their lives."
"Huh," the president said. "Wouldn't that be nice? Nice enough that I can't imagine it will ever happen. I'll give you 2-to-1 odds the old guys all kill one another and things get even worse."
Loyston nodded.
"Certainly possible, sir."
"Should we step in before it gets out of hand? Maybe send some troops to make sure this truce sticks no matter what the bees decide?"
Green said.
Loyston shrugged. "I don't see how. I've spoken to the Joint Chiefs. Before Niger, maybe we could have done something, but now, we're stretched damn thin."
Loyston began ticking off items on his fingers.
"Beyond Africa, there's the Iran occupation, plus the peacekeeping forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. General Blackman says we're on the edge of not being able to properly defend the country from an attack, and the rest of the Joint Chiefs agree."
Loyston lowered his hand.
"We just don't have anyone to send."
The president frowned, thinking. The pen started moving again, then froze before it reached the desk.
"That's not true," Green said.
He looked at Loyston and smiled.
"I can send you."
Chapter 38. Lee was a desert. Any movement would split her, broad cracks opening in her skin. Her eyes were full of grit. She wouldn't, couldn't open them. But she could feel the particles moving behind her eyelids, scratching against the lens. Her mouth was a gulch, parched and dead. She was baked dry and hyper-aware. The weight of the sheet and the heavy hotel bed blanket pushed down to around her knees. Her clothes from the night before, still on her body. The air conditioner's hiss. The sound of running water from the bathroom. Tantalizing, soothing. But out of reach. As getting to it would require leaving the bed. So she lay there, eyes closed, still. Waiting for her body to give her a signal that she could move without shattering, pain cradling her skull like a mother's hands around her newborn. Flashes from the previous night ran through her mind, staring at the prediction in Will's notebook, trying to understand what it meant, pulling back onto the highway, driving in silence until they reached the outskirts of Toledo, exiting, pulling up at a Hampton Inn.
"I feel like this is my last stop," she'd said. "Convince me I'm wrong."
"How?" Will answered. She'd seen the fear in his face, and knew she wasn't being fair or kind. Will needed her desperately, and she was about to use that need to force him to tell her the things he'd been holding back. She wanted the story, and up to this point she'd been willing to be patient. No longer, apparently. Lee didn't mind being involved in something huge. In many ways, that's all she'd ever wanted. But she needed the narrative, so she could place herself within it. Helping the Oracle escape angry mobs out for his blood, that was one story, sure. But that prediction, a man reveals himself, just those few words had made it clear that the story she'd been telling herself was tiny, just the smallest part of what was actually happening.
"Tell me the rest, the pieces you've left out. Otherwise you're on your own."
This was a bluff, but Will didn't know that. And so he started to talk. He showed her the notebook, the lists, the color-coded calamities, the scribbled, scratched-out efforts to make sense of the site's slowly tightening grip on world events. Will told her about the billions of dollars, money that he had come to feel was essentially a bribe from the site, a prize for being its agent in the world. He told her about 15,000 people dead in Uruguay, about the blackouts, about Niger, and how those things and everything else were locking together bit by bit, more each day. He told her about his last prediction. The numbers 23, 12, 4. He told her about the walk into traffic in Montevideo, and other attempts like it, things he had kept to himself. He called them tests of the site's control. That wasn't what they were. He gave her, at last, details about the Oracle safe house waiting in the west, a cabin hidden in the mountains, bought, prepared, and stocked by Hamza and Miko in anticipation of a day when Will's identity might be blown. It wasn't connected to any of their other accounts or identities, which meant that if he could just get there, he could put the pieces together, come to understand the site's plan from a place of blessed anonymity. Figure out his part in all the terrible things the site had done, and decide what the Oracle could do about them. Will's vaunted plan, the driving force for their trip west, at the end it wasn't some huge, complex machination that would magically turn everything around. He just wanted to feel safe. The Oracle spoke for more than an hour, there in the parking lot of the Hampton Inn in Toledo, Ohio, as the sun set and the sky turned dark. Lee just listened. When he stopped, she put her hand on his, letting it stay there for a moment. Lee started the car and left the parking lot, driving until she found a liquor store, where she purchased too much alcohol. Then back to the Hampton Inn, where a room was obtained for cash, and too much alcohol was consumed by both of them. And they kept talking. She came to understand that Will hated that the site had saved them at the laundromat. It wasn't benevolent. It was a sign of the site's casual power over him. A message that all his struggle, all his pain, it had been anticipated. It was part of the plan. The site put Will in danger, and then it saved him from it. Each time the message getting stronger that Will should just lie down, surrender, let it all happen. The Oracle lived in constant anticipation of the next horrible thing the site would do, mixed with the knowledge that if he had just kept his mouth shut in the beginning, if he hadn't become the Oracle, then it would never have happened. It was a contradiction he could not reconcile. The site was in control, but yet, somehow, the choices all belonged to Will from the start. No one had forced him to do anything. But he'd done it all. The causality of it escaped him. The why of his own existence completely incomprehensible and impossible to ignore. She remembered Will drunkenly suggesting an idea to her, a way to subvert the site's plan, or at least do something good for the world with the Oracle's influence. She remembered her drunken, enthusiastic agreement, him pulling out one of his burner phones and fiddling with it for a while, laughing. Her enthusiastic, clumsy pass, which Will, to his credit, deflected. More drinking. And finally not sleep, but a span of darkness, unawareness, each in their own bed. Now morning, and Lee was a desert. She heard Will sit on the bed opposite her. "Awake," he said, his voice soft. Lee raised a hand off the sheets, not wanting to risk opening her eyes. "I have a glass of water here, and a cup of room coffee," Will said. "It's terrible, tastes like chemicals and poison, but I can't go out to get anything better. I have two Advils, too. I had to take one, I'm sorry. But the other's next to the water if you need it."
"I do," Lee said.
She rolled onto her side, taking the water and ibuprofen first, drinking the whole glass, then the coffee. And her first sip confirmed Will's description, chemicals and poison, but better than nothing. "I need to get back on the road," the Oracle said. "Are you coming with me?" Lee looked at him, just a man and not just a man at all, trying to save the world.
"Yes," she said. "You deserve my help. You deserve everyone's help. But I want to be clear about something. There's a mercenary angle to this for me. I'm sorry that you've had to endure so much, but that's not the only reason I want to stay. I want the rest of the story. For me."
"Obviously," Will said. "I'm not an idiot." Lee braced herself and sat up, her head pulsing in time with her heartbeat.
"How do you keep going?" she asked. "If it were me, I might just hide, I guess."
Will closed his hands around his coffee cup, staring down into it.
"I could do that. But then I'd just be surrendering. At least this way I'm still making choices. I'm still trying. I'm still me. The minute I stop, that ends. I'm just a tool for the site. Maybe it's an illusion, but it's what I have."
He glanced at the small table between the two beds, noticing a cell phone face down. He frowned.
"Do you remember me using that last night?" he said. "It's one of my last phones."
"Yeah," Lee said. "But I don't remember what for."
He picked it up, turning it over.
"Me neither. I need to get rid of it, but let me just see what I..."
Will swiped the phone screen. He stared at it, his frown deepening.
"Oh, yeah," he said. "That's right."
"What?" Lee said. "What did you do?"
He turned the screen so Lee could see it. On it, a prediction, in the same format as all the others on the site. On September 4th, 2022, the government of China will be toppled by a revolution that stems from more than 50 years of persistent human rights violations.
"Whoa,"
Lee said. Her voice was hushed.
"Is this real?"
"No," the Oracle answered. "I made it up."
Chapter 39. On August 15th, 2024, a breakthrough in stem cell therapy will allow complete repair of spinal cord-related paralysis. Will tapped the screen and the prediction went live to the site. They were just crossing the border between Nebraska and Colorado. Finally off I-80. I-76 would take them to Denver, and then it would be I-70 for all but the very last leg of their journey. He thumbed the phone off and performed the now familiar ritual of removing the SIM card and battery, tossing the pieces out the window as the car sped along the interstate. Will adjusted his headphones slightly and tapped the volume control on the little MP3 player he'd bought in an Iowan travel plaza, a compromise that allowed Lee to listen to the radio while she drove. He'd stocked it with songs ripped from the small set of CDs also available for purchase, mostly greatest hits collections. Right now, it was Prince, a bunch of the 80s classics. Will liked the tunes, but the real star for him was always the production. No one built an arrangement like Prince. The Oracle notebook lay open on his lap, every page covered with his cramped handwriting in various colors. The pattern had evolved past just the blue, red, yellow, and green he'd started with. He'd added a whole new run of shades to deal with the effects of the false predictions he'd been putting up. Purple, orange, turquoise. The prediction about China was just the first. He'd been kicking around the idea ever since meeting Anthony Leuchten and realizing that the government had planned to use the Oracle's influence to affect world affairs. Lee's reaction to this plan had started skeptical and shifted to hugely alarmed once she'd had a little time to think over the implications. For one thing, she thought that trying to essentially trick China into improving human rights inside its borders could backfire in any number of ways. She'd taken some Asian poli-sci courses in college, and knew the country's history much better than Will did. But it was done. He'd put up several more false predictions since, although he discussed them with Lee first. The idea was to run interference patterns across the site's plan, possibly disrupt it in some way. Barring that, just to help. To improve things. Will knew he was slowly but surely burning the Oracle's credibility. But he wasn't sure that was such a bad thing. The site was using that same credibility to sow chaos. Maybe it was better to try to do something good with it. If the real predictions were destroying the world, maybe a few false ones could fix it. The spinal cord thing was designed to spur research in that area. He'd been reading about it in Wired, and it seemed like something that should be getting more money. Likewise, a prediction about large, easily accessible mineral deposits and near-Earth asteroids, and a few others. So far, it had been a lot of effort, some extra colors for the notebook, and not much else. His new predictions generated their own streams of after effects, but never really connected with the site's existing web. Just dead flies on a windowsill. He only had one untraceable phone left, and he was saving it for one last site update. A Hail Mary pass he'd only use if he absolutely had to. Will leaned back, looking out at the mountains through the windshield, letting his mind drift, listening to the radio edit of Alphabet Street, which lacked the 5-minute instrumental coda. He thought about the site, free associating. It was strange. The web wasn't growing the way it originally had. The nexus points that it combined early on to create what Will thought of as the big effects, the problems with the global economy, the Niger invasion, and so on, had stopped interacting. The first, second, and third rounds of connection had all been relatively quick. Quick, that was, for events happening on a worldwide scale. Like dominoes falling. Now, though, it was as if everything was in slow motion. As if the gears of the site's great machine had pulled apart and were no longer churning the world along to some unknown destination. It felt like the site was holding its breath, waiting. Will sighed. He closed the notebook and reached down between his legs to the floor, where a small stack of unread newspapers and magazines awaited. The top item was that week's copy of The Economist, on stands that morning. The cover story was about Kondustan. He opened the magazine, looked at the article, and frowned. He was exhausted, it looked long, and The Economist used tiny type. More importantly, he still wasn't sure the site had anything to do with Kondustan at all. Virtually every event he was certain was part of the site's web had several Oracle-related triggers, more than one string connecting it to the other sections of the web. But Kondustan only had one, the
The warlord Tutakul's decision to attack the city of Uth because the United States was too busy stepping on the forces of the Prophet in Niger to intervene. And even that was speculation. No one knew for sure if it had played a factor. Will forced himself to dig into the Economist article. Not much new, really. The Elder Bees and the Council were still sequestered up in the mountains above Uth, as they had been for the past several weeks. Anthony Loyston was on the ground, talking to both sides, trying to find a diplomatic solution to an increasingly tense situation, which conjured up a nice image of Loyston sweating in some desert hellhole surrounded by men who might kill him at any moment. The magazine had sent a reporter to the other side of the world to obtain an interview with Tutakul. He had proven elusive, but the reporter had managed to track down one of his subordinates, a Colonel Bishtuk. He repeated most of the facts Will knew from his own research. His ancestors had built the mosque. His people still had every right to the mosque. Their heritage had been stolen. His leader, the great Tutakul, would lead them to victory. But then there was something else. Something new. Will's eyes widened. "Holy shit," he said. Will grabbed a green pencil from the passenger side door. He flipped through the notebook on his lap until he found the pages related to Kondustan. All the entries were written in blue. Will drew big green dramatic circles around the edges of the page, designating it as firmly site-related. "I knew it," he said to himself. According to Colonel Bishtuk, Tutakul had decided to attack Uth when he saw the city's lights go out during the worldwide blackouts that spring. He called it a sign from Allah. And at that very moment, Tutakul had vaulted onto his horse and ridden to gather the tribes. The invasion in Niger had given Tutakul the opportunity. The blackouts had given him the inspiration. And the sight had caused them both. Will reached up, pulling off his headphones. "Lee," he said, "check this out. Kondustan's definitely a big part of the picture." He looked up to see Lee staring straight ahead, her face slack. "Kondustan?" she said in a dazed voice. "Yeah? Kondustan. How about that?" "What's the matter?" Will asked.
"Listen to the radio, Will," Lee said.
He hadn't even realized it was on. He focused his attention on the words, a deep voice speaking in a language Will didn't understand, emphatic and angular. "What is this?" Will asked. "I can't understand it."
"It's audio from a clip that a local TV station in Kondustan broadcast last night our time. That's their morning. The translation will come through in a minute." "They've already run it a few times," Lee answered.
"Can you just summarize?" Will said.
"Yep," she said. "Tutakul's got a nuke."
"What?" Will said.
Lee glanced at him. She looked ill. "The anchor said it's an old missile from the USSR, an SS-24. They used to mount them on trains and trucks, I guess, and drive them around. They were completely self-contained, and they kept them moving all the time so a US strike couldn't take them out."
Lee reached down and turned off the radio.
"They aren't even sure if it works, and he's not saying how he got it or where it is. The Tutakul's calling it the Sword of God. And he's saying that the council in the mountains is taking too long to come back with their vote. He thinks they're screwing with him, stalling until his enemies can regroup."
Will hunched forward, gripping the notebook in both hands, his mind deep in the site's web, trying to understand. "What does Tutakul want?" he asked.
"The elders need to come down from the mountains within 48 hours, or he'll launch the Sword of God against Uth. If his people can't have the mosque, he doesn't want anyone to have it."
Will leaned back. "Jesus," he said. "They better get word to the old guys to hurry up their vote."
"They can't," Lee said. "They're hidden in a cave or something. That's the whole point, remember? No one knows where they are. They'll come back when they come back."
"To a big smoking hole in the ground," Will said. "I don't understand why the site would do this.
What the fuck would be gained from some city in Central Asia getting vaporized?
Will, you don't understand. It's not just Uth. All night long, while we were asleep, the world... it's all falling apart.
Lee's knuckles were white on the steering wheel.
Kandustan has a defense treaty with China, so China said that if Uth gets nuked, they'll send attack bombers into the mountains where they think Turakul is hiding. Half the Muslim countries in the world say they'd fight to stop that, and that includes Pakistan and Saudi Arabia.
Pakistan and China both have nukes too, Will said.
And the Saudis, Lee said. Apparently for a while. They thought now would be a good time to announce it. The U.S. has a defense treaty with them, just like China with Kandustan. So if China starts fighting the Saudis...
so that'd be it. Everyone would jump in. Boom. Will closed his eyes, his gut churning, thinking about the sight laughing at him for putting up his idiotic fake predictions, trying to change a world that wouldn't even exist in a few days. In one fucking night, he said. He felt Lee's hand on his back, a tentative touch.
What's going to happen, Will? Tell me you know what's going to happen.
Will thought, and wondered, and had nothing to say.
Chapter 40 Lee pushed her cart down the aisle, looking at the nearly empty shelves, attempting to ignore the news broadcast running on the store's speaker system, giving an update on the global crisis. Nothing she didn't already know, and nothing she wanted to hear. Panner's Market was the only grocery store in Feldspar Creek. A market, really. A small store for a small town. Never with all that much in stock. Still, this was apocalyptic. Gaping holes where the staples should have been. No flour or sugar. No toilet paper. No coffee. They had almost reached the cabin. According to Will, it was a 15-minute drive up the mountain from the town. The place had taken on a talismanic quality in Lee's mind. A refuge where they could finally settle in and think. Figure out a next step. Until, of course, the world ended in a huge nuclear fireball. The feast had been her idea, a celebration of their arrival at the cabin, and a sort of screw you to the site, a dance to the graveyard. Hamza had supposedly stocked the safe house, and safe was relative under the circumstances, with canned goods, bottled water, and other non-perishables, enough to last for a while if they needed it. But fresh was fresh. And so Lee had pulled into Panner's Market in search of milk, eggs, fruits, and vegetables. A few good steaks, if they could be found. They had talked about grilling that night, maybe splitting a bottle or three of wine. Apparently, though, she wasn't the only one in Feldspar Creek thinking that way. The tiny butcher's case held only a few graying packages of ground chuck. Lee grabbed them and made her way to the register, where she waited her turn behind a line of still, silent shoppers. The checkout clerk, a well-padded older woman with brilliant bottle-red hair and a name tag labeling her as a Claire, worked the line with quiet efficiency. Claire looked a little off her game. Her makeup was unevenly applied, and her hair was messy.
"Hi there," she said as Lee stepped up.
"Hello,"
Lee said. She began unloading her cart and placing the groceries on the conveyor belt. Claire swiped Lee's items across the scanner. She rushed it and hissed with impatience when the laser didn't ring up the price on the first try. Lee opened her purse and pulled out her wallet. She unsnapped it and thumbed through the sheaf of bills inside, literally the last of their cash. She considered the fact that her trip west with the Oracle had used almost exactly, to the penny, the amount of money Will had brought with him from New York, and let her mind skitter away. She'd only known Will Dando for about a week, and she was already largely post-coincidence.
"You're lucky you made it," Claire, the clerk, told her. "We're closing early today."
"I get it," Lee said.
"I just want to be home, you know?
I do, Lee agreed. I really do.
Claire stopped scanning Lee's items and settled back, holding a thin plastic bag containing the one anemic-looking head of lettuce the market's cold case had left to offer. She looked bleakly at her empty market.
You know, I've made more money this week than I do in the whole down season up here. I should go spend it, you know? Buy something nice, while I still can.
She pressed a button on her cash register.
$48.97, she said.
Lee nodded and looked down at her wallet, then dimly realized that words from the news broadcast were penetrating her consciousness, despite her best efforts to screen them out. President Daniel Green. Cancer. New prediction. The site. The Oracle. 3 to 4 months. The Oracle. The Oracle. Lee's head swam. Nausea churned in her gut. Hazily, she fumbled a few bills from her wallet and dropped them on the checkout scanner. She grabbed the grocery bags and walked toward the exit, ignoring Claire, dimly aware that the woman was holding up the money and calling after her. She had paid too much or too little. It didn't matter. Lee walked quickly to the Nissan, parked at the edge of the market's small lot. Will was visible through the windshield, in a cap and wig and glasses. He was always in disguise now, unless he was behind a locked door. His head was down. The pose felt to Lee like he was looking at his phone. The phone he had just used to fuck them both. She ripped open the car's rear door and tossed the grocery bags into the back seat, then slammed it shut. She took a deep breath, held it, released it, then opened the driver's side door and slid inside. Everything all right? The Oracle asked. She was wrong. It wasn't his phone. He had the notebook on his lap. The notebook in which the Oracle attempted to figure out the plan of the site. The green pencil was in his hand, and an entire page was covered with lime-colored text. She knew what that meant. He explained his color-coding system to her during a particularly dull stretch of road in Indiana. And so she knew it was unusual, unprecedented, probably represented some significant breakthrough, and she couldn't manage to give even a single shit.
Fuck you, Will, Lee said.
She pulled the door closed and sat with her hands on the wheel, almost shaking with tension. The Oracle considered this, then closed the notebook, marking his place with the green pencil. You heard, Will said.
Yeah, Lee said. I heard. Of all the things you could have done, all the predictions you could put up on the site, you gave up the one thing that's keeping the President of the United States from coming after us, not to mention poor Hamza and Miko, and at best, throwing us into prison for the rest of our lives. I heard.
Will sighed heavily.
Well?
Lee asked. I figured it out, he said. I know what the site's doing. I know what the numbers mean. Through the windshield, she could see a helicopter making its way through the sky. Will had told her that Feldspar Creek was a wealthy town, a little mountain paradise for rich Californians who flew to Denver or Grand Junction and choppered in. The Oracle's cabin was probably just one of many secluded helipad-equipped getaways currently being used to ride out the end of the world. She wondered who was in it. A studio head, a movie star, a politician. Did it matter? No. Not at all. Very little did at this point.
You figured something out. So what? Lee said. Too little too late, you know?
But it's not. Will said, his voice calm. That's the whole thing. That's why I put up the prediction about the president. Can I just explain this?
Lee looked out the window, breathing hard.
She could call her dad, could call Reimer, and get some money wired to her. She could get back to the city, could write all this up, could... Lee turned the key in the car's ignition, and the engine came to life. She pulled up to the exit from the lot, the front of the car nosing onto the main drag through Feldspar Creek. A turn to the right would head out of town, back east and eventually home. The Oracle could get out, or not. His choice. To the left, she saw a waterfall, a silver ribbon winding its way down the face of the mountain that waited at the end of the road. The cascade split into two streams as it hit some ledge or promontory, dividing into two paths. Left or right? She thought about good decisions and bad decisions, and how hard it could be to tell them apart. Lee chose the mountain. She turned left. Will exhaled. I thought about Hamza and Miko, he said. They're safe. They're out of the country, and we know from the radio and stuff that he's hired guards. 24-hour protection. Plus, really, this isn't about them. It's about me. I had to do something, Lee. I just couldn't sit here and let the sight end everything.
But why did you have to do this? Lee said. How could giving up the cancer prediction possibly affect things in Kondustan?
You've read the same op-eds I have. The U.S. is staying out of Kondustan because Green doesn't want another military action in an election year on top of Niger and the others. But if he knows he's going to lose the election and stops worrying about how he'll be perceived by the voters, he's freed up to do something beyond just sending that idiot Loyston.
Lee opened her mouth to respond, but Will cut her off.
And you know what? It sucked that he was going to win again. He put the coach onto us. He's the reason for those blackouts. He's the reason Branson outed me. Fuck him.
Will glared out through the windshield. Lee saw the sign for Laird Lane, the long dirt road that led up the final stretch of road to the cabin, and turned. She hadn't seen another house for at least a few miles. It seemed that the safe house was as isolated as promised. Small consolation.
Why couldn't you just let us be here together? Lee said,
her voice rising in pitch.
Even if there is a war, we could have ridden it out here. We could have been safe. Doesn't that matter to you? Do I even factor into this decision?
She realized she was yelling. She realized she had said together and we. She realized how frightened she was. For herself. For everyone.
Don't you think it's a little fucking selfish to do something like this without discussing it with me?
Selfish? Lee, that's the whole point. This is something I'm doing for everyone but myself.
While ignoring the one person who's been standing by you through all this bullshit.
Lee, listen. Of course I thought about us. I told you. I know what the numbers mean. I have a plan and...
Come on, man! Getting the predictions doesn't make you Batman or whatever. The Oracle is a fiction, Will. You're just a guy.
Laird Lane ended in a large clearing. And there, at last, was the cabin. Small but perfect. Wood and shingles. A front porch complete with rocking chairs. Everything Will had claimed it would be. And next to it, perched on the dirt, was a black, insectile helicopter. The same aircraft Lee had noticed back at Panner's Market.
What the hell? Will said.
And then noise, incredibly loud. Four distinct reports, echoed a moment later by the sound of all four of the car's tires blowing out. Lee fought the wheel. Black-clad men holding rifles rushed out of the tree line on all sides, sprinting up to the car as it slewed to a stop. They lifted their weapons, pointing them directly at Lee and Will. One man, imposing, granite-faced, stepped close to the car on Lee's side. He tapped the driver's side window with the barrel of his rifle, making a small metal-on-glass tink that was possibly the worst sound Lee had ever heard.
Out, he said.
Chapter 41 A slow, cautious exit from the car, then an escorted walk to the cabin. Up the porch steps, through the front door, and into the living room. The first time Will had seen it in person. He saw evidence of Hamza and Miko's careful planning everywhere.
the CB radio, the metal crate pushed against one wall that Will knew contained over 100 burner cell phones ready for use, the encrypted laptops and sat phone, the safe holding cash, gold, and gems, instrument cases, rustic but tasteful furniture, the stocked kitchen. Everything the Oracle would need to survive in a world that knew his name. And sitting on the couch, holding a steaming mug in one delicate hand, nails painted a bright, pretty shade of blue, was the reason he would never use any of it. The coach.
"Hello, Will," she said. "So nice to see you again."
"Fuck you," Will said.
"It sounds interesting, but I think my men are in a hurry to finish our work before the local law enforcement comes looking to figure out what's going on."
"How did you know we were coming here?"
"Oh, please. I found you once. What makes you think I'd ever let you go again? I've been tracking you two kids ever since you left New York. Swapping out the town car for that rental made it a snap, really. They all have transponders, so the companies can find them if they're stolen or something. Did you not know that?"
Will glanced at Lee. She looked terrified, of course, but also angry. He felt incredibly stupid. Will Dando was emphatically now and forever, not Batman. "What do you want from me?" he said.
"Nothing," the coach said. "Nothing at all."
A sound behind them, the unmistakable ka-chick of a pistol slide being racked.
"Oh, Jesus," Lee said.
He turned to see one of the coach's men, the same man who had ordered them out of the car, was now pointing a dark gray hammer of a gun at Will's head.
"No," Will said,
his thoughts fuzzed, adrenaline streaking through his system. He knew there was a pistol in a small plastic case in a closet upstairs, and a few rifles in a cabinet in the kitchen, but they might as well have been back in New York for all the good they could do.
"You don't want to do this," he said,
trying hard to project a note of authority into his voice.
"I have to do something. If I don't, it's going to be bad, really bad." "What do you need to do?"
the coach said, a note of curiosity in her voice.
"Let me go and I'll tell you. I can tell you all kinds of things. I'm the Oracle."
The coach shook her head.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Dando, but my employer gave explicit instructions. You see, you appear to be more dangerous alive than dead. You've been a busy boy up here. That business with China and the bit about stem cell research?"
The coach made a small chiding noise, clicking her tongue against her teeth.
"I've been getting calls for days to end your rampage across the geopolitical landscape. The only reason I said no was because you had the president protecting you. But then you sold him out."
She made a small gesture, and her mercenary placed the pistol at Will's temple. The circle of metal felt red hot against his skin, a tiny stove burner making it impossible to think about anything else.
"Forgive me, Will, but that was stupid. President Green was absolutely furious. He personally gave the kill order for you. No plausible deniability this time, I guess."
She scratched the side of her nose with her free hand, a gesture too casual to seem remotely real considering the circumstances.
"I'm almost disappointed," the coach continued. "I guess I expected something more interesting from you, considering, you know, all this build-up."
She shrugged.
"Should have known better. Expectations. They'll get you every time." "I've got money," Will said, desperate. "I can get you anything you want. God damn it. What do you think all of this has been about? Can't you understand that there's a point to everything that's happened? And if I die, it will all fall apart?"
The coach held up a finger to her lips.
"Shh," she said. "It's time to go."
And then, for the first time since the dream, Will could breathe. There was nothing left for him to do. no decisions to make. No globe-spanning drama with the Oracle in its starring role. No future. Just Will Dando, at the end of his life. He closed his eyes, entirely focused on that little circle of metal against the side of his head.
"In the car," he heard Lee say. "There's a notebook. Go get it. Read it. You'll understand. If you kill him, you kill yourself. You kill everyone."
A long silence.
"Open your eyes, Will," the coach said.
Will did. She had stood and was considering him carefully.
"Okay, I'm interested." "Go get it, Grunfeld," she said.
And the circle of metal disappeared from the side of Will's head. A moment or two later, and the leader of the coach's team, Grunfeld, apparently, returned with the notebook. He handed it to her without a word, and she paged through it, one eyebrow raised, making an occasional noise of interest.
"Huh," she said, snapping the notebook closed. "When I take a job, I tend to get a bit focused. I can be extremely goal-oriented. Big picture bores me. I'd even go so far as to say it's my tragic flaw."
She tapped the cover of the notebook with one fingernail.
"But this is all big picture, isn't it? This is the big picture, you might say."
"Yeah," Will said. "It is." The coach said.
"It pushes plausibility to suggest that you prepared this on the off chance you might run into me. I just skimmed, but it seems to strongly suggest that something very bad will happen unless you, personally, stop it."
"That is exactly what I've been trying to say."
"Fine, fine," the coach said,
her tone irritated.
"But you have to understand, it is a very big deal for me not to follow through on an assignment. Getting things done is my entire brand. So if I am going to consider not killing you, then I will need a very good reason."
She held up the notebook.
"This," she said. "How bad are we talking?"
"End of the world," Will said. "And we have no time."
"About what I thought," the coach said. "So saving you means I'm saving myself and my husband and my children and grandchildren, just as the lovely Ms. Shore suggested."
She looked out the window, toward the waterfall visible through the slightly warped, imperfect panes, and tapped her fingers against her lips.
"Okay," she said, turning back to Will and holding out the notebook. "Do what you have to do."
Feeling a bit dazed, Will took the notebook.
"But please don't forget that I came here to kill you," she went on. "I am not your friend. Bluffs, trickery, or chicanery of any kind will result in..."
The coach gestured at Grunfeld, who lifted his gun in a mildly threatening way.
"I'm sure it won't come to that, though," she said, smiling. "Now, where are we going?"
Will stared at the coach, trying to think of any ruse, any bluff that could get them away. He looked at Lee, the woman who had, without any doubt, just saved his life. Her eyes were wide, clearly hoping he would return the favor.
"Denver," he said.
Chapter 42.
"We believe the Chinese incursion into Pakistan's airspace was entirely intentional, Mr. President."
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Ira Blackmon, pointed with his pen to the large screen taking up most of the far wall of the Situation Room. It was currently showing a satellite image of the Pakistan-China border, with various air and land-based military units from both sides overlaid on the map as graphic chits, China in red, Pakistan in yellow.
"The scans are all clean," Daniel Green thought, "but the doctors made it clear that doesn't mean anything. Lymphatic cancer comes on quickly. I could be clean 1 week and have one foot in the grave the next."
"A display of power in the wake of the Oracle's prediction about the revolution in a few years," They want to show they're as strong as ever,
the National Security Advisor added. Green reached for a cup of coffee in front of him, full, black, and took a sip. It was hot and perfect. The world was ending, but God forbid they let the president's coffee get cold.
But they turned around, right?
Green asked, sending the question out to the 20 or so uniformed military advisors crowded into the room.
It wasn't an actual attack.
Correct, Mr. President. The Pakistanis scrambled fighters to intercept, and the Chinese returned across their own border, the chairman said.
Do you think they will attack?
Green said. A long, not entirely reassuring glance between the National Security Advisor and the chairman.
Not without provocation, sir.
Define provocation,
Green said, almost wishing he hadn't sent Tony Loyston away. He was better at dealing with the military.
Almost anything. A misunderstood order from home. An itchy trigger finger. But the most likely cause would be Turakul launching his nuclear weapon at the city of Uth,
the National Security Advisor replied.
The Sword of God, Green said. Correct. And we still can't find the goddamned thing? Not yet, sir. We have drones scanning the region looking for radiation signatures, but the terrain makes it extremely challenging. If he's got it stashed in a cave or a deep valley, we might never...
The door to the Situation Room opened. In itself, an unusual enough situation that every head in the room turned to look. Green's secretary, a formidable woman named Meredith, entered and walked over to him. She leaned down and spoke quietly into his ear.
Telephone call, Mr. President.
I presume it's extraordinarily important or you wouldn't be telling me about it,
Green said. Meredith nodded.
It's a Major Carter Grunfeld, Mr. President. He used an authorization code I wasn't familiar with. Sundown. Do you want to speak to him?
Green's mouth quirked upward.
Sundown, he said. Yes. Put him through.
Very good, sir, Meredith said.
She lifted the handset for his secure phone, tapped a few buttons on its face, and handed it to him.
Major, what's the status? If you're using Sundown, I'm expecting good news,
Green said.
Mr. President, this is the Oracle, an all-too-familiar voice said. I need a favor.
The president's grip tightened on his phone. He could feel its edges digging into his palm and fingers, and wished he could squeeze the damn thing until it shattered.
What makes you think I'd be interested in doing you any favors at all?
Because then I'd owe you one. And because it would make me much more willing to forget about the whole kidnapping thing in New York, and the fact that you tried to have me killed today.
Son, I have no idea what you're talking about,
Green said.
What I do know is that you're not very good at keeping your promises. Why the hell you chose to release that prediction, to make a private matter so drastically public, I'll never...
This is bigger than you,
the Oracle snapped.
You know what I'm capable of, as much as anyone can. Will you help me?
The president looked back into the Situation Room. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs was pointing his index finger at the National Security Advisor, red-faced, indignant. The screens along walls displayed 15 different versions of the next 24 hours, 12 of which resulted in the end of the world.
What are you looking for?
Green said.
No promises. Just tell me what you want, and we'll see.
I need to speak to Turakul, the Oracle said.
The president spasmed out a sound, something between a chuckle and a groan.
How the hell do you suppose that'll work? Maybe you haven't heard of the Sword of God? Catchy name, right? I should have him manage my campaign. Man as a gift for marketing.
I can stop that, Mr. President. I can keep him from launching that missile. You just need to get me in front of him, the Oracle said.
What makes you think I have that power?
Green asked.
You're the President of the United States, the Oracle answered.
Green waited, but that appeared to be all Dando had to say on the matter. Ordinarily, he enjoyed the average citizen's belief that the president could do more or less anything he wanted, like some sort of wizard in a fantasy.